are halfway through the week here in the Main Street studio. Welcome to the show. I'm Craig Blumenschein. In the second half of today's show, we'll take a Prairie Plates visit to Spaghetti Western, a Fargo Italian eatery blending old country authenticity with a cinematic flair, plus a nostalgic visit from 2022 with Marilyn Haggerty at Darcy's Cafe in Grand Forks. We are pleased to be joined by our great friend, Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. He's the Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of North Dakota and host of the public radio show, Why? Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, where he explores how philosophical ideas intersect with daily life and current events, and my guest once a month in this segment we call Philosophical Currents. Jack, always great to see you.
Always a pleasure to be here. Love talking on Prairie Public. Love being a part of Main Street.
It's later in the summer. The opening of the University of North Dakota, of North Dakota State University, and all of the states and the country's colleges and universities is coming down the pike, Jack. What is the value? What is the role? What is the purpose of college today? That's our topic. Let's start right there. Should the goal of higher education be primarily personal enrichment? Is it career preparation? Is it something else? Why do we have colleges today, Jack?
The answer is yes. The answer is all of those things. And when you have this conversation, you have to remember that nothing is just one thing. And that an institution the size of, say, the University of North Dakota is many different things to many different people. And it often has a benefit that people are either too young to predict or don't have enough experience to know or just get surprised by because life is uncertain. But the first understanding, the core of what a university is in general is, I like to say it this way, to create and disseminate knowledge. And what that means is a university is a research institution first and foremost, develops a sense of what's true, what's knowable, and then shares it with as many people as possible. Because knowledge is not intellectual property. Knowledge is not something that you keep from others. The more I know, the more I have an obligation as a teacher to share it with my students, my colleagues, the audience of Prairie Public. So the first mission of any university is to create and disseminate knowledge, and then everything else is supplemental because it's a complex institution that has a lot of other functions.
Colleges and universities, their funding has been in the news. Funding has been withheld from certain universities, from the federal government. It seems like there's pressure for the role of colleges and universities to change. Take us in the Wayback Machine, Jack. How have universities and colleges changed over time?
Well, this is super interesting because the history of colleges and universities are complex because of how societies and cultures change. The earliest universities prided themselves on being alternatives to a religious education. People would go become priests or be part of the church, and folks who wanted more secular exploration were attracted to these other institutions. And interestingly enough, that's why we have regalia when you graduate. That's why you wear the robe and the hat, because it's supposed to be an alternative to the vestments. They're supposed to be the same kind of pomp and circumstance that you would get, say, at the Vatican or something like that. And as secular knowledge increased and as the mission of learning law separate from theology or understanding medication, what it means to be a doctor separate from prayer and other such things and cultural medicines, the universities increased. And what we called knowledge and how we categorized it also grew more complex. Through the 18th century, there were basically three subjects. There was moral philosophy, which covered what we call political science, psychology, law, ethics, all the social sciences, all the humanities. And then there was natural philosophy, which is what we would eventually call the hard sciences. And then there was logic, which was the study of reasoning. This eventually split up into a couple other small areas. And then the first major appears in Harvard University at around the turn of the 20th century, a little earlier than that. This starts to professionalize universities. And for the first time, universities start being vocational beyond being a doctor, beyond what they would say reading for law. And you start getting programs in engineering, and you start getting programs in what becomes economics, and you start getting programs in other things. And universities become much larger, much more powerful, and the disciplines and the fields of study become much more specialized, which is the natural consequence of progress, although that's a other conversation.
Jack, and the university's main role then is disseminating knowledge, but certainly also shaping civic responsibility and moral character, as you alluded to a while ago. Is it still the same today as it was just a decade ago, relative to those important roles of colleges and universities? Or are we in a fast-changing world relative to college and university?
We are at a transition point for a couple different reasons. Certainly in a democracy, part of the role of higher education is to educate citizens, to help them think critically, to help them understand how the world works. That's also supposed to happen in elementary, primary, and secondary education. It doesn't happen in the same way in the United States than it does in European countries. So, and I'll explain why I'm saying this in just a second. So the way the American system is structured, our early education isn't nearly as sophisticated as European education. And so our students don't come to university with the same humanities background and the same general knowledge background that that European universities, Western European universities have. And so traditionally, the first 2 years of the university were structured to make up for this general education, right? And so you get students who have to take English 101, philosophy 101, sociology 101. The goal of that is to give students a general education and to make them have requirements. And historically, and certainly up through my college experience, you would do that. And then the second semester, sophomore year, you would pick a major because you had done all of your generals, your essential studies, and then you went on to do the more specific technical courses in your major. During the Obama administration, Secretary of Education made a rule, and that was you could not get federal loans if you didn't declare a major. And this seemingly technical thing, which was designed to actually make education go faster and cheaper, changed everything. Because what it said was, you aren't supposed to come into college with a sense of exploration. You're supposed to come into college with a very narrow sense of what you want to do and focus only on that. And that then did two things. First, it made students go into higher level classes without the general skills that they developed the first 2 years. And so they did worse in their classes. And second, it meant that they often learned 2.5 years in that they didn't want to do what they thought they did at 17 years old when they declared their major. They burnt out, they'd start over, and now all of a sudden students are going to college for 5 or 6 years instead of 4. So that changed everything and changed the progress of students. And now we are in a position, and this is a political comment, and this is a matter of argument and contention, but we're in a point in time where it seems as if politicians want students to learn less, where there is a distinction made by between college-educated voters and non-college-educated voters, or, you know, uninformed voters, as they are sometimes called. And so one of the parties is more committed to developing this education, and another party is committed to undermining this education. And the universities have become a center point of debate for cultivating a partisan foundation rather than the general civic mindedness that a university in a democracy is supposed to develop. And so those two things combined means that the university is in flux in a way that I don't think it's been in a long time. And even if you go back to the 1960s during the civil rights era and the challenges of what constitutes an educated public, there was still a commitment to creating an educated populace. People just disagreed as to what it meant to be educated.
We talked about this off mic just a little bit, but here we come. Here comes September. In October, I believe we're going to see, at least anecdotally, that colleges and universities in North Dakota are doing okay, if not pretty good, relative to enrollment. The numbers look fairly strong, at least at this point, anecdotally is what I feel. Jack, is it still desirable to get an education for the sake of getting an education in our current climate? It seems like in this red state, we're maybe bucking a trend. Do you agree with that?
There's been tremendous demographic pressure in the last decade because the number of young people fell. And so we anticipated lower enrollments and received them for a few years. That seems to be changing, not necessarily on the overall national level. I don't know what the birth rates were 17 years ago. I don't have those numbers in front of me, but certainly enrollments have gone up. And I know, again, in my personal case, both of my classes are closed. I'm teaching a class on philosophy of education that historically gets 6 or 7 students, is now at 31. Almost all are incoming students, first year students, and that's super exciting. Often during economic downturns, people will go to college because they can't get a job, because they want additional training, because they are stalling, or because they want to do some sort of technical field, go into engineering or go to law school or something like that. And so there are economic pressures that push people. There's also a sense that there's a kind of chaos in the world, and being a part of an institution gives people order and purpose. But there's also been a cultural shift that suggests that college is now the next step for just about everybody.
Is that changing? I feel the pressure is going a little bit away from that.
Up until and this, again, I don't have numbers in front of me, so this is my overall sense. Up until a couple years ago, I think that was changing for the better in terms of there was a sense that in order to get into the middle class, in order to develop upward mobility, you need a college degree, you need a master's. When my parents were kids in the 1950s, the standard degree was a high school degree. And people went out and had wonderful lives with a high school degree. And then starting in the 60s and the 70s, that changed. And then the standard degree when I was going to college was a bachelor's degree. Then in the 1990s and 2000s, that changed into a master's degree. And so that trajectory towards being more competitive and having greater and more powerful credentials was a way to move people upward. What we're seeing, however, is with millennials and with Generation Z, there is a sense that jobs pay so little. There is such competition for so few positions. And we are in such a transitional state in terms of employment, and you can't buy a house, and medical care is so expensive, that the outlay of education may not be worth it. And it's better to spend your money getting into the job market sooner for a lower paying job.
I want to talk about value of education next, but I want to reintroduce you, Jack. Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein is my guest. This segment is called Philosophical Currents. We visit with Jack monthly. Jack is the Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of North Dakota. So, Jack, how do we define the value of college education in today's society?
As a philosopher, I am going to start with the first and I think the most important point, which is a phrase I'll steal from the philosopher Martha Nussbaum: cultivating humanity. The first and most important job of education is to make us be more human, better human, learn and appreciate the world, discover cures, discover the beauty of a paramecia, understand why Mona Lisa is a beautiful painting, get a sense of what love is and how to have a fulfilling relationship. engage with our relationship with the world, with nature, with pets, things like that. Cultivating our humanity is our first job, and that is unquantifiable, right? Another way of saying it is, if you are lucky, you work 8 hours a day, you sleep 8 hours a day, what are you going to do with the third 8 hours a day? How much are you going to appreciate the world around you? The second job of education, again, is to the value of education is to create a better world for ourselves politically and morally. If I am a better person and my neighbor is a better person, then my life is better and their life is better and my children's lives are better. And having a moral society and an orderly society and a just society is an outgrowth of education and better for everybody. And then there's the economic investment, the sense of, am I going to get a job? Do I just want a job? Do I want a profession? Do I want a vocation? And then you start looking at quantification. So for example, on the one hand, you make a lot of money as an engineer, right? And you'll make a higher salary over time. On the other hand, most engineering programs are very, very expensive and take a very long time. And if you compare the amount of money that you put in versus the amount of money you get out over time, it isn't that much more than, say, getting a good philosophy degree, where you put in much less input, you spend less money getting it, and you get a decent job that also increases the salary over time. There's a website that I maintain called philosophyisagreatmajor.com that has all of these numbers and compares humanity degrees and philosophy degrees to other such things, right? Imagine being a specialized surgeon where you make $750,000 a year. You have to get a four-year degree. You then have to go to medical school. You then have to spend 7 years doing being an intern and a resident, that's the word, being a resident and then practicing. And that takes 15 years of your life, 20 years of your life. And so you can look at it quantifiably in terms of, what are the current job needs? What are the jobs of the future? How much do I think I'll make and how much money do I put in? How many grants I'm going to earn? What kind of loans I have to take out? And then you have to start doing the kind of math that can be overwhelming because it's guesses, right? The current move to AI, which I will say on Prairie Public right now is a bubble and is gonna pop in a couple years.
Wow.
But the current move to AI suggests that we don't necessarily know what the jobs of the future are going to be like, and you make the best guess that you can, and that's because life is uncertain and I could get hit by a truck tomorrow.
Let's hope not. Jack, as we kind of wrap up our conversation today, are you bearish or bullish from both the institution's perspective and the student's perspective that education will remain valuable to us in the next decade or two?
Education has been the single largest growth industry in the United States of the last few years. I should say last few decades. With the possible exception of diabetes care. Education continues to grow in importance. It continues to grow in economic benefit. Anyone who lives in Mayville, anyone who lives in Dickinson, anyone who lives in Minot, Grand Forks, or you know, for our quote-unquote foreign listeners, State College in Pennsylvania, Boulder, Colorado, right? Anyone who lives there knows that institutions are the foundation of an area economy, and they have to be cultivated. But we are in a point where once we figure out how to educate for current needs, education will be even more important. If AI is essential to the future, we have to understand how it works. And if AI is not essential to the future, we have to figure out how to do the things that we think AI is going to do. Our bridges are getting more complicated to build. Our cars are getting more complicated to build. Our medicine our diseases are getting more complicated to cure. And our relationships are getting more complicated. Technology isn't slowing down. The population isn't getting smaller. There is always more to learn, and education will always be the right bet.
A question for another discussion, Jack, might be for me to ask you. If you were to redesign higher education from scratch, what would you have it look like? And I think that would be an interesting reflection from you, but we'll save that for another day.
Doctor. I would love that because I already have thousands of answers in my head.
Wow. All right. We'll look forward to that discussion. Jack, it's always a pleasure. Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein is the Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of North Dakota, and he is the host of the public radio show right here on Prairie Public, Why? Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. And he joins us each month for this philosophical segment. All right, Jack, best wishes to you. You and I won't visit again until your school year has started. So hope things start well.
Working on my syllabus today, so I'll let you know how it goes.
Thank you, Jack. A body like Arnold with a Denzel face. He's smart like a doctor with a real good rep. And when he comes home, he's relaxed with pep. He always got a gift for me. Still to come on Main Street, a trip to Spaghetti Western and a cozy classic lunch visit with Marilyn Hagerty at Darcy's Cafe in Grand Forks.
I like bagels. Have some salad. All I
eat is pizza. Eat some barbecue.
Apple sauce and some nice red beets.
When you think of North Dakota's Italian food scene, you'd be forgiven for remembering Marilyn Hagerty's 2012 irony-free viral restaurant review of the Olive Garden in Grand Forks that had her rubbing elbows with Anthony Bourdain and Dave Letterman. As an old, supposedly empowering cigarette ad once said, you've come a long way, baby.
It's small, it's cozy, it can be loud, but it definitely feels vibrant and fun.
In the state's largest metro sits a little downtown corner eatery with an old-school dive bar on one side and a cathedral across the street. Talk about Saturday nights and Sunday mornings, right? Spaghetti Western may look modest from the outside, and inside it's a pretty straightforward layout, albeit with some Italian wood flair on the walls with a movie theme, you might have guessed by now. But the food is as high-end as you can get.
So we have the risotto with saffron broth, asparagus, and shrimp. It's a head-on shrimp. With our house-made gnocchi, served with four cheese and walnuts.
Rick Guion and I made a lunch pilgrimage and met up with co-owners Bridget McGuire and her husband Fabrizio Di Gianni. And yes, like the food, he is authentic Italian.
You feature some house-made pastas that you don't see a lot in restaurants in North Dakota. Can you talk about some of these homemade pasta dishes?
The homemade pasta dishes, these are like family recipes that we commonly eat back home. Some of our recipes, some of our pastas, you won't find in Los Angeles or in New York.
Fabrizio hails from the Piedmont region of northwest Italy, famous for Fiat's, Alpine Peaks, and Nutella, the popular chocolate hazelnut spread that now owns Kellogg's, by the way. Fabrizio says you can't pigeonhole cuisine from his home country.
In Italy, my dad is over 70 years old. If he drives 2 hours east, he might find a shape of pasta that he has never encountered before. The variety is huge. Every region has its own cuisine, and within that region, counties that have their sub cuisines. Piedmont is famous for truffles and game. Meats is definitely a mountainous region, but the ocean is just an hour south, so there is a lot of anchovies, garlic, that are implemented in that cuisine. The idea was to cook like we cook back home. There is definitely a lot of love that goes into it, but we do not compromise on ingredients. The prosciutto di Parma, for age 24 months, the cheeses we use are like all imported, the Grana Padano, Pecorino Romano, they are all from Italy. So there is love and good ingredients that go in it. And I hope that it tastes like that.
There's absolutely nothing wrong with Olive Garden. It holds a lot of nostalgia to some people, but you know, it's just a totally different thing. And the chain restaurants, they have their place, but it's really nice to see more scratch kitchens coming up.
Unlike the faux Tuscan art on the walls of the aforementioned chain, the decor at Spaghetti Western consists of Sergio Leone posters like Fistful of Dollars and the like, but of course in Italian. And there's a rendering of Clint Eastwood staring at you from the inside of the door of the unisex loo. Not gonna lie, it's kind of intimidating, but the vibe Bridget and Fabrizio are going for is as down home as a hug from an Italian grandma.
There is definitely like a lot of energy, especially in weekends, because we are extremely busy. I think Bridget has done an incredible job setting up and training the front of the house staff. This is a very casual place to go out to, but our service is top notch. So you can just come in, relax, and be taken care and pampered by our staff.
From the deserts of the mine, the name of the restaurant evokes, to actual desserts.
All right, so we have our vanilla bean panna cotta with berry sauce. We have our tiramisu, that's the ladyfinger coffee cocoa powder dessert, and the cannoli made with ricotta, there's chocolate chips, apricots, and pistachios.
What was your favorite dessert?
A tiramisu. And as Fabrizio explained it, it's a traditional Italian recipe. It is absolutely delicious. When I come here, I like to go through the courses and come here with four or five people. And I know that's not the traditional lunch, but that's traditional Italian, where you go through different courses. And I always like to get dessert because the cannolis here are some of the best I've had.
We got food, we got sweets. Another important ingredient of a place like this is wine. Describe how wine fits in with Italian food and specifically what you have here.
We wanted to curate an only Italian list. We wanted to just show the Italian smaller wineries.
Well, there is like 500 type of grapes used for winemaking in France. In Italy, there is 1,500. So there is all of the variety that you need. And we really try to put emphasis on more exotic grapes, more exotic wines. We try to stay away from big winery. We try to give wine options that pair well with our food.
If you had to pick one thing on the menu, what's your favorite that your husband likes to cook?
Some of the standouts would be grandma's meat sauce. That's definitely one of our more popular dishes with the house-made tagliatelle. It's just a nice meat sauce. My favorites, I would say the mushroom and prosciutto, maybe the broccoli and sausage.
I enjoy, these are family recipes that we just are offering to an extended family at this point. I'm so proud of our carbonara. We import the guanciale from Italy. The seafood pasta we make, I find it delicious. We have gnocchi, they are super popular. We make them Neapolitan style with San Marzano tomato sauce, mozzarella, and Parmesan cheese. The four cheese sauce on the gnocchi is absolutely traditional and delicious. Our risottos, I'm a risotto lover, shrimp and asparagus, sausage and gorgonzola.
While not the first family-owned Italian restaurant to call downtown Fargo home, and with exciting options in the nearby burbs like Ziti's in West Fargo, Spaghetti Western still has carved out their own popular little niche in their little corner of the FM area.
I'll meet you anytime you want in our Italian restaurant.
It's a special place. Special people come here. Special people cook here. And the food is definitely special. What an Italian feast we had today, Eric. Mangia!
Rick Yon and Eric Dethridge sampling the authentic Italian and the hospitality at Spaghetti Western in downtown Fargo. They're open for lunch and dinner Monday through Saturday and closed on Sundays. Eric mentioned beloved food critic Marilyn Hagerty, and we wondered how she's doing. Her friend Tom Brousseau says she turned 99 in May and remains active in her community, like sharing a meal with Tom at a favorite spot in 2022.
Darcy's Cafe is on the north end of town in Grand Forks, North Dakota, on Washington. It's been there for a long time, too. It was started by North Dakota businessman Darcy Fonder. Darcy was from Valley City. He went to high school in Fargo. He later managed restaurants in Bismarck and in Williston. In 1958, he came to Grand Forks to manage a popular steakhouse called the Bronze Boot. Sometime shortly thereafter, he opened Darcy's Cafe. Darcy's Cafe is small. The parking lot is rutted. The building is modest. Still, Darcy's keeps drawing full houses for its very good everyday food. Working people, hockey players, Canadians find breakfast here. The service is quick. The food is good. The price is mid-range. Those are famous words written by Marilyn Hagerty. The first couple lines on Darcy's Cafe came from her Eat Beat column in July of 2017. It's her long-running food column published in the Grand Forks Herald. And I just love her writing. So you'll have to allow me to continue with it. She goes on to say this. All I ask for breakfast is a couple of eggs fried over. Bacon, maybe. Toast for sure. coffee freshly brewed. Michelle Hychek glides swiftly, efficiently, around the U-shaped counter and the surrounding three booths and five small tables. She's a study in constant motion, no steps wasted. The clock on the wall near the window to the kitchen is designed like a frying pan in the words, "Best damn food in coffee." It seems togetherness draws customers to Darcy's. The place has a personality all its own. I'm going to take Marilyn Agerty out to lunch with me to Darcy's Cafe for a little lunch visit. I wanted to ask you how many times you've come to the Darcy's Cafe.
I couldn't count them, but say you go back 20 years or more.
Yeah.
And usually when someone comes home or comes to town, if they went to UND, the kids, they like to come out here. They remember this place, this area. What's that bar across the street? There's one. Everyone goes.
There was one called the El Rocco.
Well, you should know.
You know, I never went to the bars when I was growing up. Huh? I was a pretty straight-laced kid.
Yeah?
But
well, I had a straight-laced kid or two, but they still went to the bars.
That must have been, that was the El Rocco, probably. And then right down the street, the Bronze Boot, they had a pretty good bar there and obviously a restaurant. Was there too. And both Darcy's Cafe and the Bronze Boot were owned by Darcy Fonder, the originator of Darcy's.
Yeah.
But yeah, the North End is really interesting.
It is. It's unlike any other place that wasn't planned, but it just kind of fell together this way. It doesn't have a planned look about it either. It's just kind of here.
It's residential, it's college, Simplot is over this way, and just right across the river into East Grand Forks is where American Crystal Sugar is. Marilyn, you've reviewed Darcy's a couple of times.
Yes.
In Eat Beat. Definitely one in 2017, and then I think last year you had one in 2021. You will frequently visit cafes that you've already been to before.
I'd have to because I started doing this probably got to be at least 30 years ago. I started reviewing restaurants because I had been to a National Food Editors Convention, and the people from the Los Angeles Times were there, and the New York Times, and the big newspapers. And I came home and I thought, well, why couldn't we do this? And so I started doing it, and some people thought it was pretty crazy to have restaurant reviews in Grand Forks. Some very sophisticated people at UND thought that was weird. But one day my boss, the publisher of the Herald, came out, Mike Maidenberg, and he said, "Marilyn, I don't care what they say. I like the Eat Beat." And that's all it took when I knew that Mike Maidenberg thought it was okay.
Just a second more on Mike Maidenberg. Was he sort of the one who came to, was the inspiration for Echoes, the first book that you published?
Yes, yeah. He encouraged me to write Echoes, and it's one of the things that I really am proud of, because I put that book together. And we had a celebration at the Herald when it came out.
Yeah, I love that book. I love Echoes. And, of course, the second book that you published on Grand Forks, the one that Anthony Bourdain penned the foreword to, that one is incredibly popular.
Yes, yeah. Those were great times. They were things that just happened along the way.
Yeah.
You know, if you could plan your life, well, I probably would have become managing editor of the Los Angeles Times or something like that. But instead, I did what I did and thoroughly enjoyed everything I've ever done at the Herald and at newspapers in South Dakota before coming here.
We're visiting with Marilyn Hagerty, and we're in Grand Forks, North Dakota at Darcy's Cafe. We're going to pause, and we're going to have a bite of our food. We'll be right back.
Marilyn ordered the hamburger. I got the grilled chicken. My father's here. Well, he's having the number one breakfast, which is...
He made a good choice. I think you made the best choice, though.
The grilled chicken. You know what? I'm just a sucker for grilled chicken. But, yeah, my dad ordered the number one. Two eggs, hash browns, American fries.
Yes. Right now, it's hard to find enough people to work in restaurants where they used to be able to just reach out and get anyone. Right now, the restaurants are struggling for help. Some of them have even had to close because they can't get enough help. Yeah. It wasn't always that way, but it is right now. I think it has something to do with the prices and the pay rate. And
Well, and Darcy's Cafe is a good example. It's been around since the 1960s. Mm-hmm. It's gone through two ownerships now, and they've always been here. This place has always been here. As you've mentioned in some of the things that you've written about Darcy's Cafe, it's got this incredible personality.
Yes. Yeah. It's got the U-shaped counter, which is sort of a trademark. You can sit there and holler across the way at other people, and I always sit in one of those big booths over there. There are three of them, I guess.
Yeah.
Usually when one of my family come to town or people who have know Grand Forks and have been here a long time, they'll suggest that we meet at Darcy's.
Yeah.
These little tables right here are okay, but you're sitting right by the door of the restroom, and you have to make way for the people going in and out there. And, I mean, you got to move. If they've got to use the restroom, you've got to move.
It's definitely a cozy place, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Marilyn Hagerty, thank you so much for this little lunch interview here today. It's been a lot of fun talking to you on the Great American Folk Show.
Well, it's been fun at Darcy's.
That was the delightful 99-year-old Marilyn Hagerty with Tom Brousseau on Dakota Diners from May of 2022. Catch new Great American Folk Show episodes Saturdays at 5 p.m. or listen anytime at prairiepublic.org.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative, generating and delivering electricity to over 3 million consumers in 9 states, spanning from the Canadian to Mexican border.
Okay, is that Green Day?
Yeah, it's a Green Day song sung in Ojibwe.
Thank you for joining us again this week for Prairie Beat. I'm Danielle Webster, and this week Eric Dethridge is on vacation. So while he's off enjoying himself, we're going to hear all about KKWE. It's a station licensed to the White Earth Land Recovery Project in western Minnesota, specifically based in Callaway, and presenting on this topic this week, none other than our fearless and inquisitive radio director.
I'm Ann Olquist. Stay with us.
Can you hold on a second?
Sure,
someone's pounding on my door. Okay.
That's a common occurrence, I suspect, for you.
It very much is, yes, yes.
KKWE station manager Maggie Rosu. So I had a chance to talk to her about how the rescission, you know, that $1.1 billion amount of money that Congress clawed back for public broadcasting, how that would affect her station. Half of their budget comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and the CPB, as it's known in public broadcasting, has effectively been closed down. You can hear when we did this interview, she's pretty busy running Nuji Radio in western Minnesota.
You know, we've, of course, been following the rescission here at Prairie Public as well, because it also affects us. And we are considered a rural station as well, but KKWE is really rural.
It's on the White Earth Reservation and part of a group of public broadcasters specific to serving Native American audiences. There are Native stations in Minnesota, in North Dakota, South Dakota, New Mexico, Arizona, California, Alaska. I wanted to focus on KKWE, though, specifically because it's not licensed to a tribe, and that makes it really special. The White Earth Land Recovery Project is
a nonprofit. You may have heard of it because Winona LaDuc, who's a famous writer and speaker, that's how I got to know her in college. I went to go hear her speak. This was like back in the 90s. She ran for as vice presidential running mate. And so the White Earth Land Recovery Project is well known because of that. But in 2011, they got a license to start a community radio station on the White Earth Reservation. So I wanted to hear more about Native media in our prairie region, because this rescission will affect several tribal stations in North and South Dakota and Minnesota.
I took a listen online, and they do remind me a little bit of KABU. That's a Native station that I grew up near on the Spirit Lake Reservation, and it really is a different sound. It's different.
And that is exactly the word that Maggie used when I asked her to describe KKWE.
So I'm going to tell you we're different. Our music is different. It's a very large variety. We play a lot of traditional powwow music. I want to say every few songs is traditional Native American.
I heard a fancy shawl song just now.
Yes.
And just for a little bit of explanation, we were talking about fancy shawl song that was playing on KKWE. If you've ever seen a fancy shawl dance, it's pretty athletic. It's danced in rhythm with the music. The costumes are colorful, quite ornate, really beautiful. We're going to be live broadcasting from the Outdoor Powwow in Bismarck, actually, in September, and there will be a fancy shawl competition, lots of fancy shawl music at the Outdoor Powwow in September.
Absolutely. So earlier you called KKWE, was it Niji Radio?
Niji Radio, that's
okay.
Right.
So explain a little bit more what that means.
That was important and something that Maggie emphasized in our conversation. It means friend. And she described KKWE as a friend, not just to the reservation community and tribal citizens, but to anyone listening in their broadcast coverage area.
And what we do is really try, as a friend, to build relationships, not just in our own community, but in our whole service area.
So KKWE, it has a lot of functions. It's an alternative to Top 40. It's an alternative information source with national shows like Native America Calling. But Maggie also talked about how it's also a place for healing. She came to KKWE with a background in social work and also as the grandchild of survivors from the boarding school period. So these were schools where children, Native children, were beaten for speaking their own language, where they were forced to give up their traditions and rituals. So yes, the station is joyful, it's educational, it's informative, but for the listeners, and as Maggie described it, it's also a tool for healing.
And when I talk about addressing trauma, you know, that has happened, I really want to look at the revitalization and revival of culture and language. And so some of the things that we do on the station is bring cultural shows, you know, that we do one called Natural Herbs and Medicine, which is from a Native American perspective. A Native American does that program. And so we bring that, and that becomes healing.
And I know a lot of folks may be familiar with this history. I'm wondering about where KKWE sits in the broader context of Native radio, but also Native American cultures and diaspora.
I had a chance to catch up with Brian Bull. He's a senior reporter for Buffalo's Fire. If you're a regular listener to Prairie Public, you may have also heard him host National Native News. He gets around quite a bit. Buffalo's Fire is based in Bismarck, and so he's been doing some reporting about the impact of rescission on Native stations. He himself is a citizen of the Nez Perce Station, grew up in Idaho, and he shared with me that radio, that is a natural place that supports oral traditional cultures and how information was transmitted over thousands of years in Indigenous and First Nations was by talking.
So much really hung on oral narrative being a way to convey the history and values and the myths and historical accounts being passed from one generation to the next. And of course, and this is kind of why it vibes so well with me as a journalist, is that you had to be accurate and you had to be authentic and you had to be very detail oriented and a very good listener.
So what I'm hearing is that it's not just a nice to have radio station. Native stations are part of restoring Native language and culture that was almost wiped out.
Association with their tribal identity, so much is tied into the language because all the languages are so unique to a particular tribe or band or nation. And that was one of the primary ways that non-Indians tried to assimilate, was to strip them away from their language, that association. And so it's encouraging to hear that radio stations do broadcast either fully in the native language, or even as simple as a word of a day, that is still kind of an extension of that language and trying to preserve it.
And thank you so much for taking us into the world of Native radio this week and into KKWE in Callaway, Minnesota.
My pleasure.
All right, so this is the portion of the show where we take a quick peek into what headlines we've been working on in the Prairie Public Newsroom. And so, without any more delay, here are this week's three leads. Number one, hammer to hold People's Town Hall in Minot this week. Trigvi Hammer ran for North Dakota's lone congressional seat last year as the Dem MPL candidate. He lost the race to Republican Julie Fedorchuk, who has been hosting virtual town halls since she took office. Trigvi Hammer says he thinks in-person discussions are important. Number two, little-known property tax exemption available to daycare centers. North Dakota's Century Code says cities and counties may exempt these businesses from property taxes, and Fargo has been doing this for years. Fargo's deputy assessor says this can save daycare centers tens of thousands of dollars every year. And number three, measles infection slows down for now. We've been following this since North Dakota's first measles cases were confirmed earlier this year. Health and Human Services has confirmed 36 cases in total, but only two this summer.
Certainly sounds like you reporters have had your hands full this week with all the news coming down the pike, because that's only three, and I know there were plenty of other headlines as well.
Well, we definitely do our best. Thank you for joining us this week for Prairie Beat and stepping in during Eric's vacation to present on this issue facing Native stations.
I'm happy to do it. These are stations I've gotten to know from living in Alaska and having lived in the Twin Cities as well, and having worked with Native American public broadcasters, TV and radio producers. And I've seen it. I've seen the role that owning your own media can have, especially in a community that really wants to make sure that its traditions and rituals are here to stay. Thank you for being with us this week for Prairie Beat. I'm Ann Alquist.
And I'm Danielle Webster. We'll see you on the beat next week.
That's a wrap for this edition of Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, we'll have aviation safety expert Dr. Jim Higgins from the University of North Dakota provide us insight into the dramatic near collision between that SkyWest commercial jet and the B-52 bomber during the July 18th flyover at the North Dakota State Fair. It's a fascinating conversation, and we look forward to seeing you again tomorrow right here on Main Street.